This book tells the story of what Indians in the United States have been up to in the 130 years since the infamous massacre at Wounded Knee Creek in South Dakota. What we've done, what's happened to us, and what our lives have been like. Note, throughout this book, I use the word Indian to refer to indigenous people within the United States. I also use indigenous, native, and American Indian. These terms have come in and out of favor over the years, and different tribes, not to mention different people, have different preferences. My own choices of usage are governed by a desire for economy, speed, flow, and verisimilitude. A good rule of thumb for outsiders: ask the native people you're talking to what they prefer. It is adamantly, unashamedly about Indian life rather than Indian death. That we even have lives, that Indians have been living in, have been shaped by, and in turn have shaped the modern world, is news to most people. The usual story told about us, or rather about the Indian, is one of decline and death. Our story begins in unchecked freedom and communion with the earth, and ends in confinement and perpetual suffering on reservations. Wounded Knee has come to stand in for much of that history. But what were the actual circumstances of this event that has taken on so much symbolic weight? In the 1860s, the U.S. government had been trying to solve the Indian problem on the Great Plains with a three-pronged approach: negotiation, starvation, and warfare. Open war on its own had not been going too well. The Plains Indians had won decisive victories and forced the government to the treaty table. In 1868, the Lakota secured a large homeland on the Great Sioux Reservation in southwestern South Dakota and northern Nebraska. Then gold was discovered in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The Lakota tried to enforce the terms of the 1868 treaty and throw out the gold seekers who rushed in. Their attempts led, directly, to the Battle of the Little Bighorn, where George Armstrong Custer and the 7th Cavalry were wiped out on June 25, 1876. During the final hours of the battle, the Lakota and Cheyenne dismounted, put away their guns, and killed the remaining cavalry with their war clubs and tomahawks in a ritual slaughter. Some Dakota women, armed with buffalo jawbones, were given the honor of dispatching the soldiers with a sharp blow behind the ear. Note, throughout this book, I sometimes go with the common usage of buffalo to refer to the American bison, as the animal is known scientifically. After that defeat, the U.S. government switched tactics. Instead of confronting the Indians head-on, it encouraged widespread encroachment by settlers, reneged on treaty promises of food and clothing, and funded the wholesale destruction of the once vast buffalo herds of the plains. By the late 1870s, an estimated 5,000 bison were being killed per day. Without the bison, the Lakota and other plains tribes could not hope to survive, at least not as they had been surviving. Their reservations might have been designed as prisons, but now they became places of refuge. With the vast buffalo herds gone, and a growing white population of ranchers, hunters, railroad workers, prospectors, homesteaders, and soldiers hemming them in, the Plains Indians did what many disenfranchised people have done when threatened on all sides: they turned to God. The Indians, however, turned to God in the form of the ghost dance. The ghost dance religion started among the Paiute in Nevada. It promised a payoff. If Indians lived lives of harmony, worked hard, and danced the ghost dance, they would find peace on earth and be reunited with the spirits of their ancestors in the afterlife. As the religion spread from Nevada, it changed. The Lakota believed if they did the ghost dance the right way and lived by its rules, they would find peace in this world and the next, and all the white people would be washed away.